Support for America Reimagined comes from the Raymond James office in Idaho Falls, located at 450 B Street, and the Idaho Falls law firm of Smith, Wolf, Anderson, and Wilkinson.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Alturas Institute's next edition of America Reimagined, our weekly radio show in which we invite experts from around the country to join us for a conversation about how America might be better, what we might do to change the policies, the laws, the programs, to take a look at some social and cultural changes. As we progress down this road, it's very interesting to us today to be able to invite here in our station a very prominent filmmaker, indeed an award-winning producer and director who's worked in the world of film for the better part of 25 years, and no doubt you've seen some of her films. And so let's welcome Christine Walker coming to us today from Minneapolis. Very nice to see you, Christine. Thanks for joining.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to invite you to America Reimagined so we can reimagine America in any way, shape, or form. Christine, our audience will know your films. They know America's Splendor. They know any number of films, Darling, My Darling Companion. They know Howl. They know Factotum. You have worked with some of our generation's leading actors, from Diane Keaton to Bradley Cooper to Marissa Tomei to Kevin Klein to Paul Giamatti. I could go on, and I know that our audience is familiar with a number of your films, and of course, they should be, because your films have won worldwide praise and awards, jury prizes from far-flung places such as Venice and Cannes to Sundance to Toronto and places in between. We could fill up our entire time together just talking about your wonderful resume, but suppose that we go to a conversation instead. As an American citizen, Christine, and given somebody who's worked and lived in a variety of places in America, from California to Cape Cod, when you look at our country, have you stopped at any point to ask yourself, how might I reimagine America? What might be different to produce a better America? And I ask you this because you're in Minneapolis and there is a very difficult trial occurring right now for the trial of the officer who, in the view of many Americans, actually killed George Floyd. And just yesterday, another horrific shooting by a police officer of a young Black man who has died. So with all that background, Christine, how might you reimagine a better America?
Oh, Dave, that's such a good question. And I would love to say I'm reimagining it with lots of hope in my heart, but it's hard. I mean, I think I, like many other people, are experiencing PTSD from the pandemic, but also from the unrest that the racial unrest that's happened in this country. And as you mentioned, I live in Minneapolis. And George Floyd's murder took place in my old neighborhood where my children grew up, and they know the stores and the streets in that area. And so it's a very devastating time right now to think about a better America in realistic terms, right? I'm glad that we have a calmer government and that they are putting forth a positive spin on the role that government can play in our lives. But it's very hard to get past the sharp divisions that we've experienced over the last several years. And I've had a hard time reconciling those divisions with what I believe as a storyteller and as an artist and a human being. What I would say, though, a better America is a place where we are we're not sweeping all of that stuff under the carpet and saying, okay, now we don't have to worry about it anymore. We have, you know, different people in leadership who think differently, but that we as artists, and that's the world I'm talking about, are trying to really grapple with some of the issues that have come up over the last several years. And for me, I mean, I'm not naive. Racism has always existed. Sexism has existed. These things have, you know, they're in our society. But I feel like it's more prevalent than I thought. And I used to believe that storytelling helped us overcome all of those divisions. But I also believe that there were certain fundamental universal truths that everybody, no matter what culture, sort of shared. And now I'm just trying to figure out what those are and how to find common ground when there's so much division.
Those are really interesting points, Christine. I think all across America, most citizens are looking for bridges to the other mm-hmm. side. And it's hard to find those bridges because of the deep divides and the polarization that you've mentioned. Surely when we talk about the fact that some politicians dispense falsehoods to further inflame these divisions, it makes it an even more difficult process to find some healing point, some way of getting past the deeply inflicted wounds. When you think about your world of art and you think about life across America, and we often like to say that art imitates life or life imitates art, how do you think about those phrases given your vast work as a producer and a director over these years?
Well, it's interesting because there's this film that I wrote called Older Than America. This is a film with Bradley Cooper and a number of other well-known Native Indian actors, Adam Beach, Wes Studi, who just got an Academy Award last year. And when so the screenplay was based on stories from the director. And we had gone through six writers. And finally, and the director was trying to share those stories with this, with the writers, and we never got the script that she wanted. And so finally she and I sat down and I said, I'll write the treatment. And I wrote a 45-page treatment. And then it told her story in her mind. She was like, no, this is the story I want to tell. Please finish the screenplay. There were parts of the screenplay, which was about the Native American, the cultural genocide in Native American boarding schools in North America. There were parts of her story that were very difficult for me to write because I thought that kind of racism didn't exist anymore. And I didn't believe that the audience would buy it. I felt, in fact, that the audience would be turned off by some of the what I felt to be on-the-nose moments and on-the-nose bits of dialogue that she's just like, it has to be in there, like kill the Indian, save the man kind of, you know, phrases. And that film was made in 2006, 2007. And we just recently saw it again because it's played everywhere at the Smithsonian, and we showed it here at the Walker Arts Center as part of a retrospective of other Native American films. This was before the pandemic. And when we were watching the film, I could not believe how relevant that story was today or, you know, a year ago. And so for me, it's as an artist, I look at, you know, some of these issues and think that some of these events, some of this continues to happen over and over again. And we still have to be representing those divides, no matter what. And we have to be willing to tell the hard stories, even if not everyone wants to face some of those things. And it was her perspective, and her perspective was correct. She's a Native American woman, and just because it might not have been palatable, it was definitely worth sharing and telling.
I love that film. It's one of my favorites, by the way.
Thank you.
I like the fact that you're suggesting that people have to open their eyes to the problems of the world and to understand that sexism is a fact, misogyny, racism, all facts. We have to face up to the universe. It's hard to persuade people to do that, because then is there a sense of obligation to confront it and maybe try to improve it? Is it harder for a citizen to bury his or her head in the sand once you come face to face with the fact of racism or sexism?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. And, you know, ever since I started thinking about film and studying film, art is about, it's meant to educate and inspire, right? Mm-hmm. So educating in a way where you can open up people's minds to a certain ideas and then inspire. And to me, inspire is about action. And a lot of work that we see is not about that. It's about escapism. And it's about, you know, especially in the pandemic, trust me, there's a lot of stuff that I've wanted to see just so that I can forget the fact that can't go anywhere and I can't see my loved ones and all that. And so there is a role for escapist work. But for me, I think anything I do, I'm hoping will educate and inspiring to some kind of action. And maybe it's just about being a more empathetic person. You know, you don't have to go and be an activist or, you know, participate in marches. Maybe some of the films I've made are about just being more empathetic to your fellow human being. But that itself, that is an action as well.
I like that point. Empathy is a great human trait, and we need more of it, obviously, in this country. You know, as I listen to you talk about your industry, the world of film, Hollywood, which seems always to be in the news, sometimes more, sometimes less. But in the course of your career in filmmaking and your observations about the world of Hollywood, have you detected a shift or two or three in the nature of that industry over the years?
Well, first of all, I mean, I wasn't working yet at this time, but a big shift during my lifetime has been the rise of the blockbuster. And why that's important, you know, Jaws came out in 75, right? And why that's important for me is that over the years, to me, the industry is kind of three industries. One is the blockbuster industry, which is really what the Hollywood system relies upon. When you read, oh, this was a successful year for box office, what we're talking about is a handful of films that, you know, are doing incredibly well. And that feeds the ecosystem of Hollywood. Well, I don't make those kinds of films, of course. And then there's that other second layer, which does have other kinds of films that aren't the blockbuster. And some of those are independent, seemingly independent films. Nomadland, financed by Disney money, is part of that, is a beneficiary of the money that has come in from big blockbuster Disney films. And then there's a third kind of tier that I fit into, which, I mean, even when I started working in film, I identified it as a sort of like, it's more akin to making museum films. You know, films with a similar economic model. So you're making films that don't necessarily appeal to the masses and that's not the burden, but they have to educate, inspire, and they're geared towards another audience. You know, I love everybody in the world to see my films, but that isn't really the purpose for them. And in fact, if I wanted to make blockbuster films, I would be living in Los Angeles full time. So that the shift of the blockbuster, and then that those funds going into funding the independent film arena, and then those other independent films is really has helped me, I think about my career. And as a result, I've been able to make more films than most independent filmmakers because I understand my space. I've understood my space quite well. Another shift is technology. Technology has made it less expensive to make films, easier, provided more access. I don't know if it's created better content, but it's definitely increased the amount of content that we've been able to see. And there's a greater burden on people to find inspirational content or content that's more original. But I think in a way that's I'm not judging it. It's a good or a bad thing. It's just, that's how I see it. And of course the Me Too movement's a big shift, but.
Yes, I was just going to say, and you've worked a lot on that cause, not only as a producer and director, but through the Provincetown Film Festival, which you launched and which you serve as CEO, and your founding of the Women's Media Summit just a few years ago, you're bringing even greater attention to the difficulties that female producers and directors face in trying to have their movies made. And so you've done terrific work in that area and helped many, many women. Let's focus on the Me Too movement for a moment, because it remains in the headlines. And can you go back, because you've worked with some actresses who were among the first who blew the whistle, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I mean, personally, the Me Too movement has had a huge impact on my life and the way I think about Hollywood. And, you know, first of all, women are being able to, they're able to talk about what we knew all along was unacceptable behavior. And they're finally being listened to and believed, which is really amazing. And it's nice to be able to have conversations about what is acceptable behavior. And I mean, even when I'm saying this, it seems so bizarre that's just, you know, thank goodness for the Me Too movement. We can talk about, you know, how we feel about certain behavior. But the Me Too movement really linked certain behaviors directly to power. And it's not, you know, what women are not, or they're not uncomfortable with certain sort of personal dynamic, but rather the power dynamic that was affected because of this behavior, egregious behavior. And it's great to see consequences for egregious behavior. I mean, I remember attending the Sundance Producers Conference in 1993 when they announced the sale of Miramax to Disney. And what that did is that, first of all, it provided Miramax with this infusion of money. It catapulted Harvey Weinstein to the power broker that he became. And it really sort of enabled him to, you know, assault women for so many years. But his influence was huge in the industry. He influenced, I think he influenced sort of the acceptability of a certain culture. Yeah. And so it's huge that the women who came out against him spoke their truth and were brave enough to do that, like Ashley Judd and many, many others, that they came out and it led to his conviction and now incarceration. I would never have believed that would have happened in my lifetime. And so I'm just, you know, I can't overstate how significant it is that he's in prison and that people listen to these women. You know, I work in the independent space with films that I've made myself, but I worked on a number of big Hollywood movies. And personally, I just remember this event happening and this person was whose behavior towards me was egregious. And unbeknownst to me, the studio head was in the next room and could hear this going on. And he went to the producer of the film and said, I want to fire this person, which says a lot about the studio head. They came to me and I said, please don't. I don't want the reputation of being a person who would get someone fired, you know, for saying inappropriate things to me. Do not fire him. And I didn't want to be seen as someone who was difficult to work with. Personally, that's had a big impact on me. And now I see young women in the industry who, the fact that they're willing to sort of say something, and they won't put up with certain behavior that I and many of my contemporaries were sure willing to do.
You've seen a real evolution.
Yeah.
Rules of conduct, ethical guidelines for filming and so forth. And mm-hmm. and I think it's true. I think I read the other day that some new ethical guidelines have been promulgated governing scenes that simulate sex and intimacy. How do those kinds of things affect you when you're directing a film as opposed to producing a film?
There's a lot of gratuitous sex scenes. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, with every, we'll call it a restriction, with every restriction, there are lots of creative ways of working. You know, that's what being creative is. Be an artist, figure out how to do it without making someone uncomfortable or putting somebody in a position where they feel disempowered. Him or her. And so I don't see that as a big problem. Now the industry, they have people who now are sort of like they're coaches, but they're people who will come and help choreograph certain scenes and some of these intimate scenes, and that's helpful. And I, you know, I'm not an actor, so I don't know, but I can imagine that many women would feel comfortable just having someone in their court and someone speaking on their behalf. I have to say, I do recall, I worked on a film where the director pressured one of the actors, or he really wanted one of the actors to be topless. And she pushed back a lot. But finally he convinced her to do that. And in my role as the producer on that film, I was glad that I was able to call the agent and talk to the actor and say, if you're not comfortable, you do not have to do this. And I think just having someone approach her and have that conversation with her made her feel that we respected her and respected. And I said, at any point, if you're not comfortable, we will stop. And the scene went great. And in that situation, in that instance, I thought it was a really good scene for the film. But most of the time, but I think just knowing that you have that there are advocates and that you can have that conversation, like I said, makes all the difference.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the words of Christine K. Walker, an internationally renowned film director and audience and our and actor and producer and director. And she's played many parts in the world of film. She's our guest tonight on America Reimagined here with the Alturas Institute. We appreciate your joining us.
Thank you.
Oh, beautiful. For spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains.
Audio and guest information for all episodes of America Reimagined can be found at kisu.org. Production assistance is provided by Taylor Nadal and Mandy Gardner. For more information about the Alturas Institute, visit alturasinstitute.com. Our rendition of America the Beautiful is a new arrangement created by the talented musician Steve Eaton and sung by Idaho State Senator Sherry Buckner Webb and 8-year-old Charlotte Laval.